Hello and welcome to Endocrine Feedback Loop, a Journal Club podcast series brought to you by the Endocrine Society. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and would like to thank you for joining us for the first of our monthly podcast. Now, we've got a great article to discuss today and two distinguished endocrinologists with which to discuss it. Before I introduce everyone, though, since this is our first episode, I wanted to give you, our listeners, a bit of an overview of this podcast overall. Each month, Endocrine Feedback Loop will analyze an article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. I and one of our regular contributors will be joined by a guest expert in whatever clinical field is relevant for the article that we'll be presenting that month. So a little bit of a background about me. I'm a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee. And as one of the associate program directors for our fellowship, I have an interest in teaching critical appraisal of the medical literature, particularly as it relates to understanding study design. And what I hope to do in this podcast series is to take that and apply that critical appraisal of the medical literature, both doing it with our group, but also giving you a little bit of a background and understanding about how to do critical appraisal yourself. So in Endocrine Feedback Loop, we'll not only be presenting the author's findings and their conclusions, but we're going to give you our own thoughts as well. We'll give you insight into such things as why we thought this article was needed and important in the first place. We'll look at some key components of the methodology of each of these articles, particularly related to the pros and cons of the study design that's used for that article. We'll look at how the authors relay the findings that they discovered, how accurately they discussed their findings. And one thing that we want to make sure that we're emphasizing with every one of our episodes is whether the results should affect our clinical practice, whether we should change the care that we deliver to our patients. One thing that I do want to mention, since probably as soon as I mentioned that delving into methodology that alarmed some of you all. And so one thing that I want to emphasize is that this won't be a statistics heavy podcast. We'll certainly look at that where it's particularly relevant for points that are being made, but you don't have to worry about that if you are driving home. You are not in particular danger of maybe falling asleep on the road. So for this month's episode, we are joined by a couple of great folks. So first of all, our regular contributor this month is Rich Comey. Now, Rich is a general endocrinologist at Dartmouth, where he's the director of the fellowship program. And our guest expert for this month is Bill Young from the Mayo Clinic. Bill is one of the world's experts in adrenal disease and was the senior author on the Endocrine Society's most recent clinical guidelines on the management of primary aldosteronism. And as you'll see shortly, that makes him the perfect guest expert for this month. And I want to thank them both for joining us today for this discussion and for the work that they put into preparing for this. And as will be the case each month, everything that we will be discussing are our opinions. They are not necessarily the opinions of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. And this month, the article that we are discussing is Role of Aldosterone and Potassium Levels in Sparing Confirmatory Test in Primary Aldosteronism. And this is from the Q&A study group at Kyushu University. And this article was published in the April 2020 print edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, the JCENM. And Hironobu Umekoshi was the lead author on this manuscript. And I'll kick it off here with Rich. We'll let him lead us through the introduction and kind of point out the key points that the authors make, and we'll chime in with some of the key points that we would like to make as well. So, Rich, why don't you start our discussion off in the introduction?
Thank you, Chase, again, for inviting me to do this. I think this is a really important contribution to the general dissemination of knowledge of endocrinology. So this paper starts off with, as most papers do, an introduction. I think of the introductions as trying to set the stage for the work, trying to justify the importance of the work, and then sort of stating hopefully a hypothesis or the question that they're going to evaluate pretty clearly. And I actually thought this paper did a pretty good job of that. They talked about how the primary aldosteronism imparts a unique cardiometabolic risk. So it is thought to be a hazard for health that needs to be addressed. It's been pointed out that about 6%, and some people say 5, as much as 16% of patients with hypertension have primary aldosteronism. And I can say from our experience, if that's the case, we're not getting very many of these patients referred to us because we don't see that many of them. So it appears to be an underdiagnosed condition from when people look epidemiologically. That sort of states the importance. There's actually been some data that suggests that patients with primary aldosteronism do worse than patients with essential hypertension, even for the same degree of hypertension. So again, it really does emphasize that. And all of that is nicely stated in the introduction. They point out there's really three steps in diagnosis: case detection, which all of us do, the aldosterone renin ratio for that. And then there's confirmation tests, and there's a variety of those tests. And in this paper, they chose the captopril challenge test, but I can, well, maybe Bill Young can comment in a minute about the different tests and whether one should select one or the other. And then once you've done the confirmation, then you subtype this, which actually leads to sort of the treatment choices that you would make, especially whether it's unilateral or bilateral disease. So that's kind of the context of this. There's an underreported condition, great health significance, somewhat complex testing. That what the authors want to do here is see if they can simplify the testing. They want to see if looking at the clinical features of the patient population, you can simplify the testing and maybe skip one of the steps. And that's what the paper will be about.
And Rich, when I was looking at this, it seems to be that the authors, they're suggesting that the complexity of the test has implications for perhaps that's maybe the reason for this disconnect. Because we know from epidemiologic data, it's a very common condition. But I agree with you, and there's certainly data to suggest that this is true, is that we're not identifying as nearly as many cases as we would expect to. So I think the suggestion that the authors are making here is that part of that may just be is because this three-step process that you have outlined is relatively complicated, and wondering if they can cut out one of those steps, if maybe that would help us diagnose this a little bit more.
Yeah, they do suggest that perhaps if you could simplify this, the detection rate would go up. That is, primary care providers would be more inclined to look for this. And also that by simplifying it, it would lead to more treatment and more treatment options. While they suggest that, of course, that's not what they're going to examine in this particular paper. They're really going to look to see if the testing can be simplified. And as you're kind of implying, Chase, as well, there might be many reasons besides the complexity of the stepwise diagnosis that lead primary care physicians to under-test for this condition. So it's an interesting corollary of this, but I don't think in this paper they're going to show whether or not that's going to be the case.
Yeah, so we'll certainly look at, I think, that question they're going to try to answer is that confirmatory test, that second of those three steps that you outlined, how important that is, and is it always necessary? So, yeah, I think this would be a great time for Bill if he can kind of walk us through him being very familiar with these different tests, the ones that are out there. So, as Rich alluded to, and we'll get into in the methods, they use the captopril challenge test, but you've also got the saline infusion and oral sodium loading and also the fludrocortisone suppression. So, Bill, when you think about this, kind of what would your preference be? How do you think about the differences in this testing? Or would you say they're all kind of equivalent and it's dealer's choice, so to speak, as far as which one of these you utilize?
When we put together the Endocrine Society guidelines, there are no data to say one confirmatory test is better than another. So that's why we said clinicians can use any of the four, recognizing that what tends to happen is centers develop a comfort zone with a certain confirmatory test, recognize the potential pitfalls, and that's probably the best way to do it, to be honest. I will make a couple comments. The fludrocortisone suppression test, I'm not sure anyone in the U.S. does that. It does require hospitalization, so it increases the cost of that test dramatically. So I think, at least in the U.S., that is not used very much. So it really comes down to the captopril challenge, saline infusion, and the oral sodium loading. With regard to the saline infusion, Michael Strawasser's group in Australia has nicely shown that you get less false negatives if you do it in the seated position rather than supine. So if you're going to use the saline infusion test, it should be a seated saline infusion test. The one we use at Mayo Clinic, the one we've developed comfort with over the last 40 years, has been the oral sodium loading test. For people who have a BMI over 30, many of them are on a high sodium diet every day. You just have to take a good history, talk to them about what they're eating. And so sometimes I don't have to salt load my patients. I just, on day one, I get my aldosterone and renin, and I start the 24-hour urine for aldosterone, sodium, and creatinine.
that's helpful to illustrate. It can be, that testing can be variably complex, certainly if you're doing the saline infusion, and you talked about institutional preference there. And so I think that that's a helpful insight there. So I'd say here at Vanderbilt, it's either the saline infusion or the oral sodium loading tends to be the preferred. So Rich, as far as a Dartmouth perspective on that, do you have a sense of a preferred institutional approach for that confirmatory testing?
Yeah, we've tended to favor the saline loading test over time rather than the oral test, just because we've had a few non-compliant issues. But we've used both of them, but we tend to favor using the saline infusion, which we do as an outpatient. So one of the things that was pointed out, by the way, in this introduction was, of course, that the guidelines have commented on trying to simplify these tests. And there have been various guidelines talking mainly about the level of the plasma aldosterone and also the level of potassium is potentially indicating which tests can be spared. And that's really where the authors are going to go with this paper.
So yeah, Bill, can you give us a little bit of a historical background here? So as you were the senior author on the most recent version of the guidelines, can you walk us through that particular aspect and in particular how you look at something like that that has relatively limited data to where there's going to be a lot of expert opinion that's going to be influencing those sort of recommendations and how the guideline committee came up with that recommendation?
First of all, it appears I'm the senior author, but actually it's alphabetical and Young tends to come last. So
perks of having a last name that starts with Y there.
Right, exactly. So there were eight of us on the task force, and this was the second version of the Endocrine Society Primary Aldosterosis Guidelines. First version was in 2008. And in the 2008 guideline, it said that after a positive case detection test, everyone should have a confirmatory test. Instead of proceeding directly to subtype testing, we recommend patients with positive AR, which is aldosterone renin ratio, undergo one or more confirmatory tests to definitively confirm or exclude the diagnosis. However, in the setting of spontaneous hypokalemia, plasma renin below detection levels, and a plasma aldosterone concentration, PAC, greater than 20, we suggest that there may be no need for further confirmatory testing. So this is the crux of what the article we're reviewing today is addressing. And what they commented on in their introduction was that this was a weak recommendation. There are only two levels in this guideline, one or two, and two is actually a suggestion or a weak recommendation. And then these circles with X's in them, the more X's, the higher quality evidence. And so you can see this was based on very low quality evidence. Basically, there were no studies out there that proved this concept. So the question should come up, where'd this come from? How'd this land in the Endocrine Society guidelines? Number one, common sense. We had eight people in the room. I asked them, who's ever seen a plasma aldo over 20, suppressed renin, and spontaneous hypokalemia not be due to primary aldosteronism? Go up on the board, list your differential diagnosis. There's nothing to list. It is the only possibility. So it comes from common sense, clinical experience of those eight people in the room. And to be honest, it's a frequent question I get from clinicians here at Mayo Clinic, clinicians by email in the US and around the world. They're concerned about having to do confirmatory testing in their patient with an aldo over 20, spontaneous hypokalemia, suppressed renin. They're worried about exacerbating the hypokalemia with a salt load, no matter how you do it, and exacerbating hypertension. So in the algorithm that went with the guideline, this was the bypass loop, so to speak, where if your ARR is positive, but you have spontaneous hypokalemia, suppressed renin, aldo over 20, no need for confirmatory testing. So that's the background of where that came from and why there wasn't good evidence we could reference. We had no reference for that recommendation.
Good. So I think certainly that, thanks, Bill, is a very helpful overview. And I think certainly then helps us answer that question of why is a paper like this needed is to really fill that void to where certainly a lot of reason to where we would go with that, but don't have data to support that to say, okay, when we actually look at that, does that support what we've been doing and says, yeah, we've made a good decision in approaching patients in that way.
So again, the aim of this study really was to determine if there were settings, mainly clinical features, that would allow you to simplify the diagnostic workup, namely to skip the confirmation testing. You could also see that as they were testing this, some of the comments made in the guidelines, as Bill just outlined, to see if they had evidence that would support that supposition. The hope of this is that by simplifying the diagnosis, this important condition would be diagnosed more frequently.
And so now we want to move on to take a close look at the methods section of this paper. And as I mentioned at the very beginning, one thing that we want to be doing is taking a look at study design in particular. I think understanding what the study designs are, particularly of observational trials like this one, can give us a lot of insight into how the study's supposed to work, where we need to have concerns, where we can really understand the strengths of these. And as the authors point out, this is a cross-sectional study, and I'll give you a very brief overview of the study design for cross-sectional studies. However, this is a particular type of cross-sectional study in that it's one that's looking at the performance of a diagnostic test. So still cross-sectional, but a unique subset there. So I'll give you only a general overview for a generic type of cross-sectional studies. We actually have queued up for next month a more traditional cross-sectional study where we'll look a lot more at the pros and cons of these. But to think about it in general, so cross-sectional studies, the key component of that is that you take a population of subjects. It's often from a pre-existing database, as would be the case here, which would make this retrospective. And what makes it a cross-sectional study is that you collect all of the pieces of information at a single point in time. So this is an obvious contrast to a different type of observational study, a cohort trial, which either retrospective or prospective, where patients or subjects are followed over time. There is no time component in a cross-sectional study. All of your data, all your information, whether it's lab data or whether it's questionnaires that you collect, all of that information is obtained at a single point. And in any trial, particularly observational studies, the standard terminology that's used is that of exposure and outcome. So you are looking to separate your subjects into groups based on, if it's dichotomous, yes, you were exposed to something or no, you weren't. And exposure can mean anything. Exposure can mean a medication that you take or something that in the environment or whether you smoke or whether you exercise. So using exposure in a very, very broad sense. And then once you have split your subjects into exposed or not exposed, then what you do is you look at the outcome to see if that exposure makes it more or less likely that you're going to have that outcome. And typically the outcome is a disease of interest. And that's true for any type of cross-sectional study. And I think it's still helpful when we think about this unique subset of a cross-sectional study of looking at the testing performance of a particular test is to keep that in mind, even though it seems a little weird and it sounds odd trying to make the terminology that's used in that study fit. And the reason for that is because this is looking at a diagnostic test. Really, both your exposure and your outcome, both of those are diagnostic test results. And so the exposure that we're looking at, we'll get into it here in a second, is actually these aldosterone and potassium levels. And so whether you're either above or below certain cutoffs would count as, yes, you were exposed, so to speak, to a positive test, or no, you weren't exposed. And then the outcome is having a positive or negative of a different diagnostic test. And a really important point of these types of studies, looking at performance of diagnostic tests, is knowing what your new test or whatever new cutoff you're proposing, what it's being compared to. And the terminology that's used is it's always compared to a gold standard. And usually the gold standard, or often the gold standard, is another diagnostic test. And the way that these studies always have to be set up is you have to assume that the gold standard is correct 100% of the time, when in reality, that may not be the case. You may often have gold standard tests that are not actually accurate 100% of the time. So that's a standard way that these study designs are built. And so I think it's helpful to have that framework in mind of how these studies work as we think about this one in particular. So with that in mind, as the authors point out here in their particular methods, this is all from a single center, as I mentioned at the very beginning. This is from Kyushu University in Japan. And it was a long study where they collected all this data. So this is retrospective, but all the patient charts that were reviewed were from 2007 up to 2019. And the inclusion criteria were relatively simple. So as if you were seen at their clinic and you had a ratio, so a positive aldosterone to renin ratio that was greater than 20. And then the other key component of their inclusion criteria was is that you had to have then undergone a captopril challenge test. And all of these patients who were seen here at the center underwent a captopril challenge. So everybody who showed up that they included with a positive ratio also met the inclusion criteria for having undergone the captopril challenge test. And there were a couple of other things that they looked for that they would consider to be exclusion criteria. So one, they screened everybody for Cushing's, and they did that with a 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test. And so if you had a positive result on that, then you were excluded, and we can take a look at those numbers. Not a large number of people were excluded for that reason. The other thing that they did, though, is that the renin that they used was the renin activity, the plasma renin activity. And if you were not fully suppressed on that, so even if your ratio was high, but your renin activity was 1 nanogram per mil per hour, so the standard way that that is measured, if it was that or above, then that was considered an exclusion criteria. And so I did think it would be helpful on this, because as we treat this clinically, I think there's variable use of whether or not the renin needs to be fully suppressed to be considered to have a positive test. So I thought Bill's insight would be particularly helpful here as to thinking about that as an exclusion criteria, whether that's something that he uses clinically or has any other insight onto why that might have been utilized.
Well, this cutoff and all the cutoffs we're going to talk about today are man-made. There's no absolute, right? And we know there are going to be patients with primary aldosterone or above, have a plasma renin activity above 1.0. Might be 1.1 or 1.2. But the way I interpreted why they did this is so that there was no concern that this truly was a pure data set of patients with low renin. I think they would have gotten a lot of different type of feedback from the peer reviewers if they allowed patients with a high ratio but a plasma renin activity of 2.0, for example, to be included in the data set.
I thought overall relatively few inclusion or exclusion criteria, which I think generally speaking is what you want. Because whenever you're looking at a paper and trying to say, okay, whatever results that they're going to find here, are these going to be relevant for the patients that I see? And the more of these, particularly exclusion criteria that they have, the less and less applicable this gets for the general patient that you're going to see. So I think really a strength of this paper that you can see here in the methodology is that there were relatively few exclusion criteria, and as Bill helped us understand there, the ones that were there, I think, make sense from a pathophysiologic perspective of why you as a clinician might not consider the results here applicable for that patient if they were to have that result.
Yes, I think it's important to point out, though, that you know when you have these exclusion criteria, they define your population. So the population has been redefined that they're looked at here for people who have basically undetectable renins.
Yeah, and I think it's often a good example of where we frequently might skip the methods, because it's often the less interesting of the paper to read. But I think particularly if you're reading it with an eye of, does this affect my clinical practice, it is something that you need to be aware of as you look at that. One thing that's not commented on by the authors here, and we'll make some inferences on that later on, but it's not clear exactly how these patients ended up in this center in the first place. If you think about reasons that you might do an aldosterone to renin ratio in the first place, whether you're looking at evaluating an incidentaloma, whether you're looking at somebody who's got hypertension that you're evaluating, whether it's a hypokalemia workup, could be a variety of reasons, and it's not made explicit exactly where these patients come from, why they had their testing done in the first place, though. We'll take a look here in just a few minutes about and make some guesses as to where they might come from. So to continue on with starting to look at their protocol, as would be suggested by the guidelines, so these patients had all had their antihypertensive regimen changed to a calcium channel blocker and or an alpha blocker, so to avoid interference with aldosterone and renin levels as they're checked. And so I'll walk through the basics of their protocol, and I think it'll sound fairly familiar as to how this is done. So as mentioned before, you had to have a positive ratio, so it had to be greater than 20. And then they went on, and all of those individuals had their confirmatory testing done with the captopril challenge test. So they were all given 50 milligrams of captopril, and then after that, an aldosterone level was measured. And to have a positive confirmatory test, that had to be greater than 20. And then as the final step, the subtype classification, trying to figure out if this is unilateral, bilateral disease, they then went on to have adrenal vein sampling, and they did all of that with cosentropin stimulation. The numbers that they used for that, so using the selectivity index of greater than 5, so confirming that they had correct catheter placement, but wanting to make sure that in the adrenal veins that the cortisol concentration was at least 5 times higher than in the vena cava, and then also for actual confirmation of having unilateral disease, of having a lateralization index of greater than 4. So meaning that whenever you take the aldosterone, always divide that by the cortisol on each side, but then taking that ratio on each side and looking at the higher as compared to the lower of those two ratios. And as long as it was greater than 4, then that would be considered positive evidence of having unilateral disease. And so I did think it would be helpful for here for Rich and for Bill to comment on if they would have used any other cutoffs for that, or if that would be considered fairly standard way of as far as building a protocol for working up primary aldo.
I mean, there's two ways to do adrenal vein sampling. One is with cosentropin and the other is without cosentropin. So your selectivity index is different whether you use cosentropin or not. If you use cosentropin, you want the gradient of cortisol coming from the adrenal vein to be at least 5 times higher than that in the IVC, which is what they used. And with the cosentropin protocol, you want the dominant adrenal, if the patient has unilateral disease, the AC ratio from the dominant adrenal be at least 4 times higher than the non-dominant adrenal. So the cutoffs they use are standard. These were listed in the Endocrine Society guidelines.
Yeah, we use the same ones at Dartmouth. Obviously, I think they wanted to avoid any kind of gray zone patients, which unfortunately all of us run into from time to time, but these criteria would be the ones that we wouldn't quibble with.
And then just to wrap up some of the aspects of their protocol, so hypokalemia, they define as having a potassium less than 3.5. And of note, all of the patients who were seen in their center underwent a thin slice adrenal CT, so they had that information for all of the subjects who were included in this study. So those are some of the key aspects of the methodology there. And like I said, we'll revisit some of those and make inferences from some of those. And we'll let Rich walk us through some of the key results as the authors present them.
So what they did was they had 346 patients that had been referred to them by the definition of the aldosterone to renin ratio being greater than 20. They eliminated 19 of them. 12 had a high cortisol level, so they were concerned about possible Cushing syndrome in those. And 7 had a detectable renin, and as we talked about, they decided not to include the detectable renin patients. They were left with 327 patients, and those patients went through the confirmatory test. When they did that, 252, so the vast majority actually, had primary aldosteronism confirmed by the Captopril challenge test, and 75 of them, less than a quarter did not. And so they designated one group as having primary aldosteronism and the other group as non-primary aldosteronism in these groups. And that became their fundamental different groups to sort of compare one to the other, as Chase was mentioning, for exposures later.
And so I think it's helpful here then to go back and use that terminology. So the Captopril challenge for them served as that gold standard test. So for them, and again, this is the way that this is almost always done in these types of studies, it's a diagnostic test that serves as your yes or no, do you actually have this disease? And so this is their gold standard test to determine, do you actually have primary aldosterone? And one thing that I thought was nice, again, going back to those exclusion criteria, they didn't have very many. And then it's also nice to see they didn't exclude many patients, because you do get worried that in some of these studies you have exclusion criteria and you maybe don't even have many of them numerically, but they effectively exclude so many patients or so many subjects that you do have to wonder how applicable your results are going to be. So I think it's also nice here to see that in how many initial patients, how many were excluded, not very many got excluded. So I think it will also eventually speak to the generalizability of their results.
And now when they split these patients into these two groups, then they could compare the patients to see if they were remarkably similar or remarkably different. Again, there are 252 in the primary aldosteronism group and 75 in the non-primary aldosterone group. The ages were about the same. There were more women in the non-primary aldosterone group than the patients who had primary aldosteronism. The systolic blood pressure was really about the same, about 136 millimeters, and And interestingly, when they looked at how many medications they were taking, there was only one medication in each of the groups, although they the range must have been a little bit different because they said there was some statistical difference. The absolute number didn't come out very different. So they only needed about one medication to get control. If you looked at the potassium, it was slightly lower, you know, on average in the primary aldosteronism group at 3.6 versus 3.9 in the non-primary aldosterone group. But about 40% of the patients in the primary aldosterone group, the patients who had the confirmatory test be positive, 40% of them had a low potassium, whereas for the non-primary aldosterone group, only 7% of them had a low potassium. The plasma aldosterone concentration was a bit higher, and the aldosterone to renin ratio was substantially higher in the primary aldosterone group, 67 versus 31. So those are interesting features. The features show that there is a difference between the groups, but nothing very absolute or striking. There's obviously some overlap between the two groups. And finally, what was interesting was they did CT scans in all of them, and there was unilateral abnormalities in 61% of the primary aldosteronism group, but in 52% of the non-primary aldosteronism group as well. So it was interesting that they didn't see that as big a difference in those two groups in looking at the unilateral disease category.
Yeah, and I would say, Rich, when I was looking at this, a couple of things that stuck out. So as you mentioned, several of these, not surprising as far as a difference. So if you're looking at a group of subjects that have primary aldo and a group that don't have it, some of the differences are exactly what you would expect. You would expect the primary aldo group to have a higher aldo level, to have a higher ratio, to have a lower renin, to have more hypokalemia. All of those things make sense. To me, the two big things that stuck out in this table one that they had. So the first one is that, as you mentioned, the median number of blood pressure medications in each group is one. So we often think the trigger for this evaluation being a workup for hypertension or somebody needing several medications to get it under control. While there may be a difference in these groups, it's certainly, as you pointed, not a striking one, is that a large number of these patients are not on very many medications. And the other of these is how many of these people have what are labeled as unilateral disease. And from looking at their description of that seems to imply that there's a nodule that they see on one of the adrenal glands. And while certainly incidentalomas are very common, having a more than 50% in both of these groups is a fairly large number. And so I think going back to trying to understand maybe where these patients are coming from, at least a guess that I would have is that this may be an incidentaloma workup and is how many, maybe even most of these patients are ending up in this center in the first place. But I don't know if Bill or Rich, if you all had any other thoughts about that table one and some of the data that was in there.
Yeah, Chase, I think that's an excellent point. We certainly see nodularity in a lot of patients on CT of the adrenals in patients with PA. But that higher percentage in people without PA was a little surprising. Like you say, it may be the more of this entry point into the study, which wasn't in their methods. We don't know.
When we're applying that, and that's something that we'll have to look at and think carefully through as through the discussion is who can we apply this to? And so I think that may be something we need to think about is this may be mostly representative of an incidentaloma group. It may not make a big difference of who we apply this to, but I think it's so important to know what at least appears to be the primary population that's being studied here.
They go on from this then and analyze this data, which is kind of the meat of the paper in a way, which is that they decided cutoffs, and as far as I could tell, these cutoffs were somewhat arbitrarily decided by them. They didn't give a reason, but if you had a plasma aldosterone concentration greater than 30, what they found was that all of those patients had confirmatory tests indicating primary aldosteronism. None of them had non-primary aldosteronism, and that was true no matter what their potassium was. Then they had the second group they divided, which was they looked at the patients who had a plasma aldosterone concentration of 20 to 30. And in those patients, the vast majority had primary aldosteronism, but about 20% of them did not. So 44 patients did, but 11 did not have primary aldosteronism. However, if they looked at the potassium, they noticed that if you had a low potassium, again, their definition being a spontaneous potassium below 3.5, then in the group of patients who had a plasma aldosterone concentration of 20 to 30, all of those with a low potassium also were positive for primary aldosteronism. Whereas if you looked at the patients who did not have a low potassium, it was almost a 50-50. It was actually 62% of them had primary aldosteronism, but 38% did not. And then finally, if they looked at the group who had a plasma aldosterone concentration less than 20, they found that whether or not they had a, if they had a low potassium, the majority of them had primary aldosteronism, but some of them did not. So what they came up with was that if you had plasma aldol concentration greater than 30, you had primary aldosteronism regardless of your potassium. And if you had a plasma aldosterone concentration of 20 to 30 and a low potassium, all those patients also had primary aldosteronism. And they, as we'll talk about, they implied that those patients could be singled out as not requiring a confirmatory test. That was a big part of their findings. When they looked at disease, whether it was unilateral or bilateral, they examined whether the plasma aldosterone concentration identified with that kind of absolutism patients who had unilateral or bilateral disease, and the plasma aldosterone concentration greater than 30, while the vast majority had unilateral disease, a couple of patients did not. And also hypokalemia didn't distinguish between those as well. So these criteria were very good, potassium and aldosterone concentration, in distinguishing patients who had primary aldosteronism or not, but really were not as uniformly successful in identifying patients who had bilateral versus unilateral disease. Although, as you would expect, the higher the plasma aldosterone level, the more likely it was that they had unilateral disease. I don't know if Bill or Chase want to comment on any of those findings.
Yeah, I said the only thing I would chime in on that last part is it's a little bit different when they, so of taking that subset once you're diagnosed with primary aldo and then moving on to try to figure out the subtype, unilateral versus bilateral, is they had a relatively large number of people who didn't undergo the ABS. So of those 252 patients, 57 of them didn't end up undergoing that. Now, I don't think that, obviously, that doesn't affect any of your information upstream. So I think that's not going to affect whether that aldo cutoff of 30 or less than that with hypokalemia. But as far as understanding, certainly the unilateral and bilateral disease, you do get worried again when you see a relatively large number of patients not included, then you do have to wonder if you're really getting a representative of sample of that group. And I think it's a little challenging. So 57 people didn't undergo that subtype classification and wasn't able to tell exactly what that was. So it does make you wonder if those final numbers might not be entirely representative of the group, particularly since we don't know why those folks did not undergo that testing.
Yeah, it's worthwhile pointing out, as you're pointing out, that they when they looked for unilateral versus bilateral disease, they did the ABS sampling, and they only did 173 patients. 68 of them came out as unilateral and 105 as bilateral doing that. But they did have 50 patients who did, or roughly 50 patients or so, that were not tested, and therefore you don't really know what they would have contributed to these numbers. So that's basically the results that they came up with. And from this, they then constructed a flow diagram to say how they thought you might be able to spare some patients the confirmatory test. And it basically falls out of that data that I detailed, which was they felt their data supported the notion that if a patient with hypertension had an aldo-renin ratio greater than 20 and a plasma aldo concentration greater than 30, that you could go right to the diagnosis of primary aldosteronism. But if the plasma aldosterone concentration was less than 30, then they thought you had to stratify by potassium. If the potassium was low, again, you could go straight to the diagnosis of primary aldosteronism. And the patients for whom you would reserve confirmatory testing would be those with a plasma aldosterone 20 to 30 with a normal potassium, or those with a plasma aldosterone less than 20. And they felt that this somewhat simplified the diagnostic flow. And turns out in their calculation, this spared about 30 to almost 35% of patients would not have had confirmatory testing had they applied these criteria. I think that really covers most of what their findings were.
Yeah, and really, I think that leads nicely on to their discussion, because that's the big point that they make then. So if you use these cutoffs, so aldo is greater than 30 or between 20 and 30 with spontaneous hypokalemia, either of those two, you don't need to do confirmatory testing. This is primary aldo, you're done. So again, what Bill had walked us through earlier is similar to that approach, but gives us some data to help support that approach. And just like Rich said, it's really about a reduction of about a third of people who would meet that criteria. bacteria in their population to where you could avoid that in the first place. And actually looking at some of those numbers and using some of those more formal descriptions of the testing characteristics, they described it as the sensitivity being 100%. I think if you look at the usual descriptions of that, you would say that their specificity and their positive predictive value are both 100% using those two cutoffs to count as a positive test there. And so I think, and again, going back to what seems to have been a suggestion before, is in their discussion, they conclude that this could possibly increase the diagnosis of primary aldosteronism. And we touched on this briefly before, but I think it would be helpful for both Bill and Rich to kind of chime in. You know, first of all, do you think it's likely that it would actually increase the diagnosis of primary aldosteronism? And then do we think that's something that would be supported by this study in and of itself?
You know, I think we need all the help we can get in terms of increasing clinician awareness of PA. Just doing this podcast hopefully increases clinician awareness of PA. There's a couple studies in the literature. There's one that came out of Italy and Germany. 500 general practitioners, only 7% ever tested their patients for PA, their hypertensive patients. In the United States, we do an average of 9,145 unilateral adrenalectomies each year. And the most common reason for unilateral adrenalectomy is not primary aldo. And we have 3.5 million people in the U.S. with primary aldo. And Chase, as you, at the very beginning of this, you said it was an underdiagnosed disorder, and there's no question in my mind about that. I think 95% of people with PA go undiagnosed. Leads to irreversible CKD, cardiovascular disease. I can't tell you how many patients I see. They have stage 3-4 CKD before a clinician thinks about testing for PA. Once that happens, I can't make their kidneys better. In fact, once we cure PA, the creatinine is going to rise because they're hyperfiltrating when they have primary aldo. So I wrote an article emphasizing this issue of underdiagnosis. This is the Minnesota Department of Health's colon ad campaign. It's a similar issue. Patients are going underdiagnosed with colon cancer. They're beginning diagnosed when they have metastatic disease rather than earlier on. This billboard was put up in every city in the state of Minnesota, but basically six words says it all: cover your butt. Get a colonoscopy. So your average person on the street may not know what a colonoscopy is, but they sure can see a butt crack on that billboard, and they'll ask their friend, what's that about? You know, is that something we should be doing? So in addition to education at the medical school level, education for nephrologists, endocrinologists, primary care providers, I think this whole field would benefit by direct-to-patient interactions. So a billboard, something like that. High blood pressure, get tested for PA. They won't know what PA is, but maybe they'll ask their primary care physician what it is. And maybe their primary care physician will develop more of an interest in looking for PA.
Yeah, I certainly agree that with having this information, certainly anything we can do to simplify it makes sense. Even if in and of itself, this doesn't increase the diagnosis, certainly if a center were to primarily use saline infusion, something that's much more labor intensive and another visit for the patient, anything that can simplify that process just for, even if it's not a huge decrease in the cost and complexity, done at a much more population level, could certainly have an impact on that aspect of it and potentially increase the frequency with which it's diagnosed. So, though I do think it's hard to know if just simplifying the process would actually make it more likely that it would be diagnosed.
Yeah, you know, we've discussed this in our group, and, you know, our perception is that the primary care doctors perceive, first of all, this issue about stopping the hypertension medications has limited a lot of their desire to sort of pursue this. Secondly, I think a lot of them do use the old rubric of if there's not a low potassium, I'm not going to test for this. So there's a knowledge issue as well. You know, and then when they see the testing, they see the complete complexity, which is not only this part of the testing, but the AVS as part of the complexity, and just see it as, she's just mentioned, as a complex road to start the patient down. So I think it's a tough problem to change. And maybe Bill is right that going to the patients rather than the doctors may be the best way to kind of get this to move along a little bit.
I'll tell you, every one of those patients who's been hypertense for 10 years, one of their first questions to me is, why didn't my doctor think about this before? I don't have a good answer. I don't know why their doctor didn't think about it. This is not what our endocrine society guidelines say, but I hope the next version of the guidelines say it. All people with hypertension should have taste detection testing at least once for PA. Now that might be a little controversial. That may not be what's going to be in the next version of the guidelines, but that's what I would vote for.
Yeah, I think there could at least be an argument based on the epidemiologic data when they actually do more population-based screening tests that it's so prevalent that there's at least an argument to be made that that should be done. The numbers at least mean that it should be a part of the conversation.
And I think this is important to sort of get out because I think more and more it's realized that high levels of aldosterone may not affect all of their negative things through blood pressure. So the other perception that's out there is if you control the blood pressure, you fix the problem. And that increasingly does not look like it's the case.
So just to wrap things up here, I think particularly looking at some limitations, I want to go through, I think the authors do a good job of considering quite a few limitations to their study and making those explicit. One that I think is particularly important to point out, which we alluded to earlier, is that their positive their confirmatory testing was based on the captopril challenge test. And they point out that this is done in a Japanese institution because that's the preferred test in Japan. And recognizing then that in other parts of the world that may not be the preferred test. And I think particularly relevant, going back before this terminology of gold standard. So using that as a gold standard, adds a further level is it's at least possible that some of these patients weren't correctly classified, as is always the case with these type of studies. So Bill, what would be your thoughts on potential limitations of all of these patients having had their disease confirmed by the captopril challenge test as opposed to a saline infusion or oral sodium lowering?
Well, in terms of the subset of patients who had, ALDO greater than 20, and spontaneous hypokalemia or ALDO greater than 30 with the suppressed renin, I have no problems with that because, as you know, I think all those patients had PA, and I'm happy that was their conclusion. There's no confirmatory test that's perfect. Could some of the patients in this study not have PA? Yeah, that's possible. And could they have missed some? Absolutely. I have no doubt they missed some. But I'm not sure it really affects the main conclusion. Which is that, if you have suppressed renin and ALDO greater than 20 spontaneous hypokalemia, you have PA. Or if you have suppressed renin and ALDO greater than 30, regardless of serum potassium, you have PA.
Yeah, and I think when I was looking at this, the only thing that I would have thought of is, well, could there have been an opportunity for a different gold standard test here? Meaning not even one of the regular confirmatory tests, but actually, and this is, again, always a limitation of cross-sectional data, is that all this data is obtained at the same time. But if a different study design was used, which would not be typical for a diagnostic study, but if it had more longitudinal data, could you get some sort of an insight there? And probably not well standardized. The only potential thing that I could think of would maybe be a post-operative aldosterone level. So that obviously would only be true of those who underwent surgery, but would that potentially help confirm some of those cases or point out where possibly the captopril challenge test had actually not accurately identified that? Couldn't have been applied as the gold standard test since not everybody underwent that, but could have potentially given some insight into the accuracy of that test. A few other limitations that the authors point out. So it being a retrospective study, as is often the case, has limitations there. You're limited to what data was already obtained as opposed to a prospective study where you can actually plan what data it is that you want to obtain during your study. And then I think also it perhaps not being representative of other populations. Always hard to know what kind of variability there is in disease processes among other populations, but being at a single center and being only in Japan could have different results because of it being just a single center study. And other things, again, authors did a very good job of pointing out not all their patients underwent an AVS. We talked about that before. They mentioned that as a limitation to understanding that subtype classification because they had a relatively large number of subjects who did not undergo that. And then, as we talked about before, not having that longitudinal data perhaps has some limitations. So like I said, I think they did a really good job and really helped inform clinical practice here, where it certainly makes a lot of sense. All the experts are on board with this, but always makes you at least a little bit nervous if you don't have any data to support what you would do here. So I think this is where we want to try to end in this series, all of our conversations with of thinking about, will this change our clinical practice? And I think this could be in a different ways. It could say, well, I'm going to do something totally different based on this, or it could say, well, I'm going to have a lot more confidence in something I was doing anyway, that actually, okay, I have data to support what I'm doing here, or would it maybe tweak it? So I'm going to mostly do what I did before, but maybe because this study wasn't exactly how I did it, I'm going to adjust those slightly. And so I think it'd be great to hear both Rich and Bill comment on do you think this would be practice changing, practice confirming, or now we really need more studies, maybe we need a multi-center study, we need other locations, it needs to be in other countries. How do you think about this as far from that aspect?
Well, Chase, I would say for us, I think this is practice influencing, which is, I think we sort of have been doing this or sort of believing this. Again, you also have to talk with the surgeon when you get out there, but once you get to the AVS, the surgeons are usually very interested in the data from there. So I think we've been following this but it's nice to see the Endocrine Society's remark get supported. We'll feel better about following this in the future. I think we've been probably 70-30 following it and sometimes confirming anyway. So we probably would be a little more than likely to not do so much confirming. I will say I'm always a little concerned about a study, even of 300 patients of a relatively rare condition, but that's not enough to identify every exception. So I would like to see more studies before I really sort of adopt it all the way through.
Good. So Bill, give us your insight then. So not only as a clinician who sees this all the time, but then also as somebody who helps write the guidelines, how do you see this sort of information in either of those two settings for you?
I think it's very helpful. I think when the next guidelines come out, we can change from that weak recommendation and that very low quality of evidence categories on this specific issue. So I was delighted to see this article. Umakoshi is an excellent clinical investigator, and I think they've done a great job of summarizing their experience in Kyushu. I will add, there is an article in press in JCNM. You asked about, it's just applied to, Southeast Asia or Japan or a certain part of the world. There's an article in press in JCNM. I don't think it's available online yet, but it's there was a development cohort from China, which had 518 patients with primary ALDO and 266 patients without primary ALDO. Then there was a validation cohort from Australia with 125 patients with primary ALDO and 81 without primary ALDO. And they addressed exactly the same question. So these two groups were working, and I'm sure they didn't know they're both doing the same thing, but they addressed the exact same question. Can they support this weak recommendation from the Endocrine Society guidelines? And without going into any details, they came up with exactly the same conclusions. They didn't have the cutoff of 30 as part of their conclusion, but spontaneous hypokalemia, suppressed renin, ALDO greater than 20, specificity, positive predictive value 100% in both the cohort from China and Australia.
Good. So the next time you guys work on the guidelines, you're going to go from expert opinion only, weak evidence, to having very strong, because you've got multiple studies to go through at that point. So with that, I would like to thank both Rich and Bill for joining us for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all, as our listeners, have enjoyed and benefited from our conversation, and I hope you'll look forward to next month's edition to be released in mid-June.